and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I'm very pleased to be talking with K. David Harrison, professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College, co-founder of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, and one of the subjects of the documentary film entitled The Linguists, produced by Ironbound Films, which premiered this January at the Sundance Film Festival. David is talking with us today by telephone about his book, When Languages Die, The Extinction of the World's Languages and the Erosion of Human Knowledge, published in 2007 by Oxford University Press. Hello, David.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for inviting me.
We often hear about biodiversity and the fact that, mostly due to human interventions on the planet, large numbers of the world's species are becoming extinct. And in fact, the concept of extinction has loomed large in the field of natural history since the demise of the dodo in the 17th century. But few people know that human languages are also dying out, and what's more, few people have any grasp of just how many languages we're talking about, or how rich the diversity of languages on the planet is to begin with. So can you give us an idea of just how many languages there are and who speaks them?
Yeah, Tom, there are at least 7,000 languages spoken on Earth, and this is a fact that's not commonly known. We have incredible linguistic diversity on this planet, but it's highly unevenly distributed. So approximately half of those languages, so 3,500 of them, are spoken by just 8 million people. That's 0.2% of the world's population. Well, the biggest 84 languages in the world account for something like 80% of the world's population. So we have most of humanity's intellectual diversity is concentrated in a very, very tiny population base.
Are there language hotspots where lots of languages are spoken in small areas?
Yes, I coined the term language hotspots a couple of years ago to try to help people grasp this distribution and extinction problem for languages. And so at looking around the globe, we find hotspots where there are three criteria met. First of all, they have some of the highest diversity of languages. So they have to have not just lots of languages, but lots of unrelated languages, lots of language families. Secondly, they have high levels of language endangerment. And thirdly, they have low levels of scientific documentation of the languages. So where you get the convergence of those three things, high diversity of languages, high endangerment, and low scientific knowledge of the languages, we have what I call a language hotspot. And so far, working with my colleague Greg Anderson at the Living Tongues Institute, we've identified about 22 language hotspots around the globe.
And close at hand, people, of course, aware, you know, English and French are spoken in Canada and Spanish in Mexico, but there are a lot of other languages also spoken even just here in North America, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. Before North America was colonized by Europeans, the estimate is that there were perhaps as many as 300 languages spoken. And within the U.S., probably at least 250 or so. Now, many of those have gone extinct, and so we have approximately 160 living languages left in the United States. Many of them are very, very small, and most of them are severely endangered. So we're facing our own language extinction crisis here in the U.S., including places like Oklahoma, which is a language hotspot.
That's quite amazing. And we're talking mostly about indigenous languages, then, not people speaking Polish in small sections of Michigan, say.
Yes, we're talking about indigenous languages. Yeah. So a language like Walla Walla, which is spoken on the Umatilla Reservation in Oregon. The last published estimate for that that I know of says that there are fewer than 100 speakers of the Walla Walla language. And so that's a language that has been there as far back as recorded history and much further back before Oregon was colonized. Now, you mentioned Polish spoken in immigrant communities. That's an interesting parallel because, of course, languages also shift and disappear in immigrant communities, but in the case of Polish, the consequences are not as severe. If Polish stops being spoken in an American immigrant household, there's still a whole country full of people over in Europe, millions of them speaking that language, and so Polish is secure. But a language like Walla Walla, if it goes extinct, it's not spoken anywhere else in the world. It's absolutely unique.
So at what rate are languages dying?
It's very hard to predict. I should say it's very hard to measure exactly the rate of language extinction. Mm-hmm. Many languages pass away in complete obscurity. And I'll talk later perhaps about the fact that languages dying is itself a metaphor, of course. They don't literally die, but they lose their speaker population base. A kind of consensus estimate that many linguists have cited or agreed to is approximately a language every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that compares interestingly with the rate of species extinction, which is estimated by Conservation International to be a species is lost somewhere between every 9 to 44 minutes. Mm. So in that period ranging from 9 to 44 minutes, we lose a species. Of course, there are millions of species on the planet, and there are only about 7,000 languages. So the pace of language extinction is much more severe than that of species extinction.
Yeah. Now, I know this to some extent, like species extinction, is a natural process.
Yeah, it is a natural process for languages to change. Latin is not a living spoken language anymore. It didn't die per se. What it did was it changed into French and Portuguese and Italian and Romanian.
Yeah.
So it has successor languages. Languages have disappeared throughout history. Take a language like Hittite, of which the only evidence we have is ancient written inscriptions. Nobody speaks Hittite anymore. What's different now is this cataclysmic pace of language extinction. Never in human history that we know of have so many languages, such a huge proportion of humanity's linguistic diversity, disappeared in such a short period of time. And that's what makes it different.
Mm-hmm. And what causes this rapid extinction?
Well, again, let me point out that these are metaphors. So to say that a language goes extinct or dies or vanishes, these are all metaphors. What actually happens is that people essentially abandon a language.
Mm-hmm.
They are faced with a situation which they find themselves under pressure, whether subtle pressure or overt pressure, to give up one language and use another one. And this decision is typically made by children. Children are little barometers of social pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand that if, say, Spanish and Mixtec are spoken in their home, that one of those languages is more highly valued in the eyes of the community. And so children will drift away from the lesser valued language and towards the more prestigious language. The irony here is that the human brain is perfectly capable of being bilingual, and so there's never any reason why a child should have to give up one language in order to speak another. So we can create the conditions for a multilingual world if we choose to.
Yeah. Are languages with, say, substantial populations of speakers necessarily more protected from extinction than languages with few speakers?
Not necessarily. The population base is not the best predictor of the vitality of a language. If a language is small but it's isolated and it's not subject to outside pressures, it can remain small for many, many centuries with no change. If the language is large but it's submerged in an even larger language, the rate of shift can be quite fast. So the variable that we look at is something called transmission rate.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage of children growing up in a community are speaking the ancestral language? That's the crucial variable.
Yeah. So can you expand then on the phrase you use in your subtitle, the erosion of human knowledge, and tell us in general terms what humanity stands to lose as languages die? Because this is mostly what your book is about, isn't it?
In my book, I tried to give an unsentimental answer to the question, what happens when languages die? And the answer that I put forth is that we lose systems of knowledge that are unique, that showcase human ingenuity and adaptivity over millennia, and that contain intricate and highly sophisticated knowledge about the natural world that isn't found anywhere else. These knowledge systems include things that I look at in the book, such as classification system for reindeer, knowledge of marine ecosystems, environmental calendars, which are ways of connecting cycles and events in the natural world
mm-hmm.
to lunar or solar or other celestial cycles. And I look also at unique ways of counting, systems of doing mathematics, and other things that are highly sophisticated. For example, ocean-going navigation, which was very sophisticated in Polynesia before Europeans ever arrived. So there are all these systems of knowledge that often know things about the world that science doesn't yet know.
Yeah. You make a really startling statement, I thought, in this regard in the book, that much, if not most, of what humankind knows about the natural world lies completely outside of science textbooks, libraries, and databases, existing only in unwritten languages and people's memories. I'm quoting from the book there.
You know, the biosphere is largely undiscovered or unexplored. If you read biologists like E.O. Wilson or others, there's something like 80% of the planet's species haven't yet been taxonomized or identified by scientists.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a large knowledge gap in terms of what we know about ecosystems and species. Now, that doesn't mean that these species and ecosystems are unknown to human beings. They are very well known to the indigenous people who live in those environmental niches. And you can go in, for example, there's a wonderful study of Morovo Lagoon in the Solomon Islands in which it's very thoroughly shown that the native peoples who live in that environmental niche have immense knowledge about it, all of the fish spawning cycles, the environmental conditions, how things interlock and interweave in that environment. This is knowledge that is more than what scientists know about that ecosystem. It's more than what marine biologists know about that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really facing a knowledge gap, and we have a kind of science bias in that we tend to think that if there's anything that's worth knowing, that science knows it. But that's really not the case. Indigenous knowledge systems contain vast resources about species and ecosystems that we have only just begun to appreciate.
Yeah, that's very interesting. As a librarian, I have this image of the Earth itself as a kind of archive or library, and then human language and all its diversity existing as something like classification and naming systems for this archive. And then, of course, there's an impetus to want to preserve the contents.
That's a wonderful metaphor. I really appreciate it. I mean, the Earth is a library, and humans have encoded all of our knowledge about it in languages. What people don't commonly realize is that most of the world's languages have never been written down in any form. They exist in a purely oral medium. And while this is very resilient, it's been carried on for millennia, it's also very fragile. When you hear about these kind of grandiose projects, for example, by Google to catalog all the world's knowledge, what they're talking about is the kind of knowledge that can be captured in print.
Yeah.
But what's left out of that picture is, frankly, most of the world's languages. Most of the world's languages have never been captured in print or in writing, and they don't exist in books. And so it's a real challenge. How do we archive or preserve knowledge that is only exists in a medium of oral transmission and human memory?
Yeah. Yeah. You also make the point in the book that sometimes a knowledge of these languages can give us a glimpse not only of our own history, but also of prehistory.
Yes, there are many clues to human prehistory. It's kind of like doing archaeology.
Yeah.
And one of the more dramatic results that was reported recently, in fact, was from the Chumashan languages of California. Now, they're all extinct. The last speaker of a Chumashan language died in 1965. But these languages are spoken in Southern California, and they contain evidence in their vocabulary of a prehistoric contact between indigenous Californians and Polynesian sailors. They have a word for a special type of canoe, which is a cognate word, that is, it's been borrowed from Polynesian languages. And this is, of course, way prior to any recorded history of that area, but it's evidence that you can sift through the linguistic data and discover.
Mm, quite amazing. So you talk a lot in the book about your work in the field, and so I wonder, can you introduce our listeners to the nomadic Siberian people you talk mostly about in the book and that you spent time with, and what it's like for them to be losing their traditional languages?
I really developed my appreciation for indigenous knowledge systems and languages by spending time in the field. Mm-hmm. I lived in Siberia for a year in 1998 with the Tuvan people, and I have since returned many, many times and spent extended periods of time living with nomadic yak herders and camel herders in Mongolia and Siberia and so forth. And, these people really opened my eyes to the immense cultural knowledge that they possess about their environment and which isn't written down anywhere. Their way of life is under threat. Of course, nomadism seems like kind of an anachronism in today's world. There are still people who practice it. But along with nomadism goes a whole host of systems of knowledge about animals and how to classify them and how to domesticate them and plants and landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so impressed with this knowledge that I tried to capture little examples of it in my book, When Languages Die, to illustrate that you just can't take a system like a river orientation system that's encoded in the Tuvan language, which specifies the direction of a river current, and you can't just translate that into English or Russian or Spanish. It's not translatable.
Yeah. One thing that came to mind when I was reading your book was that this kind of knowledge has everything to do with living on the earth in an environmentally friendly way, which these people have been doing for a century, certainly. And as we're becoming in the industrial world more and more needful of developing sustainable ways to live on the planet, this kind of knowledge seems critical, and it can only become more so in the foreseeable future. And, you know, I thought, you know, reading what you had to say about Tuvan people domesticating their reindeer, that, you know, this kind of skill may come in handy again when the oil dries up. Supposing there's someone left who can tell us how to domesticate and ride a reindeer. But short of this, are there things that we can learn immediately from the people you study about environmental sustainability?
I think so. Many societies the world over throughout human history have solved the problem of sustainability and of living lightly within an ecosystem so that you do not deplete its resources. So we have much to learn, especially at this critical juncture in world history where the planet is overcrowded and it's reaching its bearing capacity.
Yeah.
Some of the things we can learn are things like, you mentioned, domestication of plants and animals. There's this new project in Norway to create a giant seed bank to store the stocks of domesticated plants against some kind of future catastrophe.
Yeah.
And these domesticated plants, rice, other grains, and so forth, these are the product of human experimentation and ingenuity over millennia. And biologists have recognized that we're becoming a global monocrop culture. We're losing our genetic diversity of domesticated species, and so they're putting it away in a seed bank. Well, you can put seeds into a seed bank, but putting knowledge into a bank, into an archive, is a much more complex process, because these knowledge systems are really only functional when they have a population base that is using them. So, as you pointed out, we don't know if reindeer domestication might prove to be a crucial or useful skill in the future. We do know that the last remnants of reindeer herding populations are under severe pressure, and they're losing their culture and their languages all at the same time. So we can't even really say what it is we're losing that might be of value to them and to us in the future.
Yeah. And just a question about what you actually do as a scientist then in the field. Are you attempting to simply document the decline of these languages, or are you attempting also to document the languages themselves and archive them as much as possible?
Well, I'm trained as a linguist, and so one of the main things we do is documentation. You go out, we make high-quality digital audio and video recordings of these languages. We write up grammatical descriptions. I've written dictionaries. I've written grammars, scholarly articles. Now, this is all important for science, but another important aspect is that we have to be an ethically engaged scientist.
Uh-huh.
So when I go out and live in a community, I also try to assess what is it that they want, what are their goals for preservation or revitalization of their language, and I do whatever I can do to support those goals.
Mm-hmm.
So if the community asks me to produce a book in the language or a reader or to help produce an archive or to help record some of the elders and circulate those recordings in the community, then I also do that. And this is not the kind of activity that typically counts toward tenure or counts in a Western academic setting, but it's absolutely crucial to do ethical research on languages that you also collaborate very closely with the community and support them.
Yeah, there seems a basic sort of human activity that's going on. And reading your book, I get a sense that you have an advantage in your fieldwork in that you seem to be able to relate to the peoples you study as an equal or as a kind of fellow witness, and certainly as a visitor. And I mean, you don't treat them or talk to them as anthropological specimens, but also you seem to be able to share an excitement with them about their culture, which becomes a kind of object of study for them also, maybe all the more intense, because you're looking at cultures that are being lost. Does this have to do with a philosophy of approach, or is it just luck? And I say luck because it does seem, on reading your book, that this kind of experience of culture and people seems not the usual scientific or even tourist sort of business, that there's something almost celebratory about it, as if you're a sort of long-lost relative that showed up.
I love the cultures that I work with and the people that I work with. I love being there. I'm energized by it. I've just come back from an expedition to India with National Geographic, and a level of engagement you get is just wonderful. People are so eager to share knowledge with you, and they're so appreciative that you're interested in their knowledge. And this has a knock-on effect in that when I come into a community and show an intense interest in what the elders are saying, mm-hmm. some of the younger generations who might not have previously been so interested, they begin to get interested. Mm-hmm. And that's a wonderful thing to see. You know, what I learned from anthropology was how to be a participant observer, which means that I try to do everything that local people are doing. I live as they live. I eat the same food. I live in the same conditions. And people are very appreciative of that, and it opens many doors. They're willing to share their knowledge with me. And I feel so humbled and so grateful when I am accepted into a community and people are willing to share their knowledge with me.
I don't know quite how to put this, but there seems to be a correlation between what goes on in the classroom, ideally, and what's going on in the field.
Well, I'm their student. So when I go out into the field, I'm the student. And my teachers are these wonderful people, sometimes elders, sometimes middle-aged people, sometimes even younger people, who can tap into these amazing systems of knowledge in these languages, and they are the experts. And so I'm literally sitting at their feet and receiving the knowledge that they're giving to me. And this makes a wonderful feedback loop into the American classroom where I teach at Swarthmore College. Mm-hmm. I bring these stories, these knowledge systems, back into the classroom, and I present them to my students to help them appreciate what's out there and what we may be losing.
I know most of these languages, as you mentioned, are wholly oral and don't have writing systems attached to them. So is part of your work to compile dictionaries, grammars, and that sort of thing, and to translate them into some kind of writing?
Linguists do have the tools to write any oral language down on paper. We have something that we call the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is a set of special symbols that can capture the sounds of any language. Now, that's not good as a practical orthography, and sometimes what communities want is a practical orthography so they can write their own language down. However, I would point out, we have somewhat of a literacy bias. We tend to think that literacy is the only path for languages to progress, and that all languages either already have literacy or they should be hurrying in that direction as quickly as possible. But that's just our particular bias, and we're really unable to appreciate what it means to live in a fully oral culture and how the human interactions and the knowledge systems are very different in a culture like that. So it's worth raising the question, what do languages lose or give up or trade off when they make that shift from an oral culture to a literate culture? And it's not just a one-way street where they reap all kinds of benefits. They may also be losing some things.
Yeah, you mentioned that actually literacy campaigns can be part of the problem in the killing off of these languages.
Oh, they're very much the problem, because literacy campaigns typically put on by state governments promote the national language. They almost never promote literacy in the indigenous languages, the small languages, the minority languages, or very infrequently. And so children come to school and they're presented with a false choice, which is either be illiterate or switch over to the major language, whether that's Spanish or Russian or something else. And that's really a false choice, because the minority languages in many cases can and do achieve literacy as well, or they may choose not to achieve literacy, but they are nonetheless rich for that choice. I do worry about the impact of national literacy campaigns. I, of course, acknowledge that literacy is a good thing and that it helps people advance in society. But I think for small languages, they need to be free to make their own decisions about whether they want to adopt literacy or not.
What about recordings? Do you make audio recordings, I mean?
Yes, I make high-quality video and audio recordings. Mm-hmm. I archive them, and I make them available in copies to the communities. Mm-hmm. And that's a really wonderful experience, because oftentimes, the voices of the storytellers have been drowned out in these communities by modern mass media, and people aren't really listening to their stories anymore. And when I go in and I make the effort to record an epic storyteller, and then I take that video around and I play it for members of the community, mm-hmm. they're always moved by it, and they want more. And they often tell me, you know, I wish we had better recordings. I wish we had more access to this, because this is our tradition. This is just as important to us as Hollywood movies or other media that are coming in from the outside.
Yeah, interesting. Oral cultures do tend to be performative, don't they? I mean, people, when they recite stories about the past, there's a whole ritual that goes along with it, isn't there?
Absolutely, and these are really premier works of human creativity and memory. I worry that in our literate culture, our brain has become so lazy and so dependent on outsourcing memory work onto the environment so we can write stuff down on a post-it note, we can type it up. We don't really have the ability anymore to memorize epic stories or long things. We don't even know what that entails. And so there's a whole different kind of cognitive dimension that you find in these oral cultures that's very, very rich, and that we ourselves may have lost in our literate culture.
Yeah, I know a lot of medievalist Anglo-Saxon scholars particularly would be kind of agog at your experience because, you know, they imagine oral cultures often as something long gone, except for Lord and Perry roaming around in
Yugoslavia.
In Yugoslavia, yeah. But
absolutely. But oral cultures are very much alive.
Yeah.
In fact, they still comprise most of the world's languages. So I would urge people who are scholars of oral tradition to take a look at some of these living oral cultures. There are epic stories, poems, tales, histories, creation myths of all kinds. Many of them have never been written down or recorded, and it's such a wonderful resource for all of us. And for a historian or a person who studies literary theory or cognition, this is a very rich resource. Mm-hmm. And again, it's very much under threat because we may be losing very rapidly most of the world's oral traditions.
Yeah. Now, as you record these languages, is there any idea of conservation here? I mean, is there any idea of resurrecting dying or dead languages through archiving them?
There are many, many efforts underway. I would say it's a very exciting global movement that's going on right now to revitalize and preserve small and threatened languages. Mm-hmm. And it's really a beautiful thing to observe. I've observed this process and these efforts in places like Australia, in places like India. There are amazing scholars and community activists all over the world doing this kind of work, and they need more attention paid to what they're doing and its importance. Languages can be revitalized, they mm-hmm. can be preserved, they can be maintained, but it can't be done by outsiders. It has to be done by a decision and the work of the speech community itself, and outsiders can come in and assist in certain ways, but really this community itself has to decide. We want to keep our language, we don't see the need to give it up in favor of English, and then they have to make that happen. There's some wonderful efforts going on around the world, and in the U.S. in places like Oklahoma, where languages are actively being revitalized.
You have a series of interesting case studies in the book, as we mentioned, and I usually ask this question of my guests on the show, how do you go about doing your research? And usually when I ask that question, I'm talking about how do you go about working in libraries and what libraries have you visited. But as we said, you know, your library is really the people who still speak the languages in question. So how do you go about learning one of these languages?
Well, there are many techniques. So linguists, for example, have a technique for going in where there's no common language, and through a process of information sharing, you can start from absolute zero and bootstrap your way up into basic communication. It's a very painstaking process. I've done it before. More typically, what you do is you go in and you would use a common contact language. So if I was working in India, I might find people who speak both English and the language I'm interested in studying.
Uh-huh.
In Siberia, I might find people who speak Russian and the language I'm studying, or in Bolivia, Spanish. And then when you have a contact language, that makes things somewhat easier, but also it biases the research. So what you really want to do is you want to learn the language that you're trying to study and communicate in it as much as possible, if mm-hmm. not exclusively, because it has a unique way of expressing itself that is not captured in, say, Spanish or English.
Yeah.
So I try to learn the languages I'm studying. I try to use them, even if I only know a dozen words or so, I'll use that dozen words as much as possible to try to bootstrap communication up to the next level.
Yeah, so you immerse yourself in the culture, basically, and have the people you're with teach you how to speak in the language.
Yes, as I said, they're the teachers, and I'm the student. I'm there to learn from them.
That's interesting.
And in my experience, people have been very, very generous with their time and expertise.
Yeah, I noticed when you were talking about working in Siberia, you were talking about using Polish and Russian as a common contact language, and it occurred to me you must have to then learn these languages also. So I just wondered, how many languages have you worked in, and is it easier for a linguist to do this because, you know, your understanding of the way language works?
Well, sure, it's easier to learn any successive language once you've learned a couple other ones. Languages get easier to learn. They get harder to learn as you get older, however. And so, you know, I don't really bill myself as a polyglot. I do speak Polish and Russian. I speak Tuvan, which is a Siberian language where I lived for more than a year, and a number of other small Siberian languages. that are nearly endangered or extinct now, some with under 30 speakers. And in recent years, I've been working in India. I'm working on learning a language called Sora, and working on a couple others. And as I said, I'll use whatever I have of a language, even if it's only 25 words.
Yeah.
I'll use that as much as I can to try to get up to the next level.
That's interesting. You know, because we have this idea often that the more languages you know, the more you're liable to get them mixed up, but that isn't really the case, is it?
Well, there's some truth to that, too, of course.
Yeah.
The brain is finite. And
yeah.
I do meet people around the world who are very impressively multilingual.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not uncommon to meet people in northern India, for example, who speak five or six languages with great ease.
Yeah.
And so clearly the human brain can be multilingual, and I would suggest that the multilingual brain is smarter than a monolingual brain, and we're all enriched by linguistic diversity. It seems like a cliche, but it's really very much the case.
We were talking several weeks ago on our program with a social historian of science, Jeffrey Bowker, about scientific archiving. And he pointed out that classification schemes and naming itself has as much to do with forgetting as it does with remembering. You know, that is, by classifying something, we essentially make a decision about what we want to remember about some experience or thing and what we believe we are free to forget about it, which is usually a lot more than what we want to remember. And if we didn't do this, it's questionable whether we'd be able to think at all or conceptualize, of course. And what you have to say about the Tuva and the way they classify reindeer seem to me to be an absolutely perfect example of this. And I wonder if you could talk about that classification system a little.
I've surveyed in my book, When Languages Die, many animal classification systems around the world. And these are really works of genius. And they are abstractions. The human brain makes sense of the world by creating abstractions and categories,
mm-hmm.
and classifying things into categories. But the strategies that different languages use for this can be radically different. Now, Western biologists classify animals according to the principle of shared descent. They want to know what's genetically related. Indigenous peoples have different concerns. They may classify birds, for example, according to their diet or according to their song or their usefulness or some other shared morphology. They're not interested in genetic descent of animals per se. They're interested in other criteria. I would say criteria of usefulness. The Tuvan people that classify reindeer have an ingenious system with really four dimensions. So any given reindeer can be classified according to its age, its sex, its rideability or usefulness as a pack animal, and its fertility. So if it's male, has it been used as a stud yet for breeding, or has it been castrated? And if it's female, has it given birth to offspring yet or not?
Mm-hmm.
Now, a Tuvan child learning this system couldn't sit down and say, here are the four parameters of reindeerhood.
Yeah.
They get that system for free just by learning the labels. So
mm-hmm.
by learning the labels for different types of reindeer, the child gets along with that some highly sophisticated packaged information that they never have to explicitly learn, but they end up knowing, and that is that reindeer are usefully classified along these four parameters and not, for example, their color or their size or other qualities.
Yeah, the way we match and sort things is really embedded in our languages, isn't it? So,
largely it is,
yeah.
Yes.
You make a really interesting comment in the book. I'll read it, actually. It's a quote, that we are still largely in the position of pressing our noses to a glass case in a museum to observe an isolated specimen, imposing our notion of order on the world while remaining blissfully ignorant of entire systems of knowledge arrayed all around us. And, of course, you know, we are in the 21st century now collecting huge quantities of data about the Earth and moving into what's sometimes called an era of cyber scholarship in the sciences. And our ideas about classification, if this data is ever going to be made useful, have to become a lot less rigid. So, you know, we're not locking ourselves into essentially just knowing what we already know. And Jeffrey Bowker, whom I mentioned, used the term mnemonic deep in this regard and the importance of allowing for diversity and change in classification systems and naming schemes. So can the study of esoteric languages help us in this? And of course, I suppose the answer is yes.
Well, not only esoteric languages, the study of all languages. You know, we're very much stuck in a paradigm of false discovery. And it's very common to read in the press that a team of ornithologists or zoologists went to Suriname or they went to New Guinea and they came back and they announced a discovery of 5 new bird species or 10 new fish species.
Yeah.
Now, this is very common rhetoric. But when you look closely, And I don't fault biologists for this. This is what they're trained to do.
No.
But it is a bit of a false paradigm, because what they didn't do was they didn't go into Suriname or New Guinea, spend the time, talk to the local people in their own language, and try to appreciate what they know about those species. So those species were not undiscovered. They were unnoticed by Western scientists.
Yeah.
But they were certainly not only known about, but taxonomized, classified, used, perhaps even domesticated by the local people. So this is, nothing has really changed since the early colonial period, when Captain Cook went out sailing and he took along naturalists with him, and they named all the species they encountered, well, completely disregarding what the local Hawaiians or other natives knew about those species. And so we need to, I would challenge people in the bioinformatics sciences to think about ways to integrate knowledge that's already out there with their own classificatory schemes, and because that will enrich all of us.
Yeah, you mentioned in the book the project called UBIO. Is that an instance of this kind of thing?
Well, that UBIO stands for the Universal Biological Indexer and Organizer, and it's a grand project, a very ambitious project, to try to systematize scientific knowledge about species, because typically what you have when you're dealing with a species is you have its proper name, its Linnaean taxonomical name, which scientists use, and then you have a lot of vernacular names out there which refer to the same thing. And they have made an effort in recent years, and I commend them for it, in including vernacular names in the database. But when you look at the kind of vernacular names they have, they tend to be from languages like Japanese or Finnish. They don't yet have good data from the languages of New Guinea or the languages of Suriname or Bolivia or Native America. And this would vastly enrich not only the database itself, but our understanding of how things group together in sensible ways.
You mentioned that languages spoken by people who have observed patterns among species can help in understanding complex organization and animal behavior. And I thought it was interesting, you mentioned a Brazilian tribe that distinguishes 85 different species of wasps and 56 species of bees, some of which can be distinguished only by smell.
Well, these are the Kayapo people of Bolivia. I haven't worked with them personally, but I've read extensive literature, and they do seem to have been among the world's foremost experts on the social insects. And so they knew all about wasps and bees and ants and termites that appeared in their environment, and they had very, very sophisticated schemes for classifying them. And it's not that certain bees can only be classified by smell, it's just that the Kayapo chose as the salient characteristic, in some cases, the smell of the bee. Now, that's something we wouldn't typically think of.
No.
But their knowledge can be shown to be highly sophisticated and, in some cases, exceeding what was known to science. So scientists have gone into the Kayapo territory and, quote-unquote, discovered new species of bees and wasps.
Yeah.
But, of course, the Kayapo were well aware of these species.
Yeah, so this kind of observation can be very, very specific, can't it?
Yes, there was a species of butterflies that has a wide range across much of Mesoamerica. It's the Astrapes fulgurator. And for more than 100 years, biologists thought that it was a single species, and it was cataloged as such. When they went in and did a genetic study, they found that it was actually what they call a species complex. That is, it was 10 separate species, of which the adult exemplars all looked alike, and so they'd been classified together. Now, again, looking at the indigenous cultures of that region, some of the indigenous cultures, including, the Tseltal people, had a scheme that classified these butterflies not according to the adults, but according to the larvae, and even more specifically, the diet of the larvae, because the larvae would, of course, eat certain crops that the people were raising. And so it's entirely possible that the indigenous people knew that this was a species complex and that it was usefully split rather than lumped, as it were, before Western scientists knew that.
Interesting.
So we just have to keep our eyes open. I'm not claiming that indigenous knowledge systems are always better or more sophisticated.
No.
I'm just claiming that sometimes they can get their facts right in a really interesting way, in a way that's not yet known or appreciated by science.
Yeah. You have a wonderful chapter on environmental calendars and how attuned people can be to observing minute changes, say, in the moon shape, for instance, or changes in plant life. and how the way that some peoples describe their calendars can tell you much about how they organize their labor also. Europeans used to do this as late as the Middle Ages with the labors of the months that we often find illustrated at the beginning of medieval manuscripts. Can you talk just a bit about the way some of the languages that you've worked with organize time?
Humans have always been preoccupied with the moon, and they've built their societies around lunar-based cycles. And so many indigenous cultures have very complex calendric systems where they tie moon phases or lunar cycles to specific environmental events. Now, this is a correlation that they would have arrived at after centuries of observation, but among Siberian peoples, for example, you might have a month that's named Edible Lily Bulb Month, or Hunting with Dogs Month, or any kinds of references to certain animals that need to be hunted during that period, or certain crops that need to be harvested. These systems were fairly sophisticated, and they're all being swept away under the global calendar as we move towards sort of systematized ways of timekeeping. But they reveal a lot about prehistoric humans and what they were preoccupied with as hunter-gatherers and foragers. So I would say these environmental calendars are very rich systems, and they're kind of a glimpse backwards into human prehistory. And they hold some of the keys to human adaptation survival.
And then besides mapping time, you also talk about the way people map space as being often very different than what one would expect.
Yeah, when I lived with the Tuvan nomads in South Siberia, I had a very basic dilemma. I needed to learn how to say go. And from my Western perspective, it ought to be simple to just drop in on any culture and figure out how to say go. But in Tuvan, it's not simple at all, because in order to say go, you must specify relative to the direction of the current in the nearby river. Even if that river is not visible to you or out of sight or over a mountain or something, you have to be able to say whether you're going with the current, against the current, or across the current. And so what the Tuvan language does is it forces its speakers to pay attention to a feature of the local topography in order to even to be able to say the most basic thing like, I am going. And I've, as an outsider, it took me a really long time to decode the system, because it was so second nature to local people that they couldn't explain it to me. They couldn't say, here's how you say go. You orient yourself to the nearest river, you acknowledge the direction of the current in that river, and then based on that knowledge, you select one of three possible forms for the word go, and that's the correct form. And so this is an example of how language is connected to the land, to the local topography, how it encodes environmental knowledge in a very subtle way, but a very powerful way, that forces people to pay attention and to know something about their local ecosystem.
You have an interesting, kind of funny passage about getting lost in the landscape with someone who didn't know the language and didn't know the signs that he would have needed to know to get you to where you were going easily, right?
Yes, and in Siberia, as in many places around the world, these indigenous knowledge systems are rapidly breaking down. And it's really sad to observe this kind of alienation from the land. And this is not by people who've moved into the cities. This is by people who still need to be able to survive and live in those environments. And yet, because of the language shift, they're losing these systems of knowledge that have been essential to their ancestors for survival.
Yeah, it was interesting, too. You mentioned that people not only then keep track of the landscape in this way, but they keep track of one another, and they always seem to know where all the other related families are in a certain group, even though these are nomadic peoples.
Well, there are all kinds of social networks, and what impressed me in Mongolia is that what, to the Western urban eye, looks like a very empty, sparsely populated landscape, to the local people, it's very densely populated and densely networked.
That's
and
interesting.
And so they have means of keeping tabs on each other, of passing information along. Frequently, I would show up at a campsite and they would have been expecting me. And it was amazing to me that these kind of information networks exist in what looks like a very thinly populated steppe culture in Western Mongolia.
Yeah.
But it just goes to show that as an outsider, you can never fully appreciate the kinds of knowledge and circulation of knowledge within a society until you get in and participate in it.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned also in the book that counting is different in different language systems, that essentially mathematics is to some extent linked to language.
Right. We're conditioned to think of mathematics as a kind of axiom of the universe, but languages have constructed radically different ways of counting and number systems. And these are all, again, under threat. They're all being swept away by the kind of global base 10 counting system. But a language that I was looking at in India recently called Sora, they use base 12 as their counting system. And there are languages of native North America that use 4 or 6 as a base. And so these are really radically different ways of doing mathematics, of construing mathematics. And again, we don't really know what it is that these knowledge systems might reveal about the world or about human cognition or human culture. And yet they're vanishing before our eyes.
Yeah, it's very, very, very interesting. And we haven't really talked about it, but these languages can tell us a lot about the way the mind works, can't they?
Well, that has really been the premise of modern linguistics, is that linguistics is not so much about languages, but it's about human cognition. And every language is a unique instantiation of the potentiality of human cognition, and therefore very valuable to scientists as a possible example of the types of cognitive structures that people can build and can manipulate. And this is true, of course. It's kind of a cold scientific perspective, because, of course, languages are more valuable to the people who speak them. But scientists, they're also very valuable because they do provide fundamental insights into how the brain is structured and how cognition works. And so we're losing, I would emphasize, we're losing not just languages, but we're losing most of the world's linguistic diversity. And so we'll really be handicapped in our ability to investigate human cognition without these languages.
The thing that strikes me most about the worlds into which you give us a glimpse in this book is that despite the fact that we think of ourselves as living in the information age, we are losing literally entire universes of not just information but knowledge, and that is information that is directly tied to human behavior and experience, a knowledge that has been accrued over centuries, if not millennia. And this casts into relief the vast data collecting practices that we engage in and the building of a supposed universal archive in the face of this loss. The building of this archive starts to look a lot like Walmart, you know, where everything is just a variation on the same handful of brand name products, or to use another analogy, cable TV, you know, where we have hundreds of channels now, but, you know, all we can find on those channels are hundreds of versions of a limited set of programs. You know, we don't really have any choice or diversity at all. And this leads me to two questions. The first one is, can anything be done that we aren't doing to keep linguistic diversity alive on the planet? And then the second question is, while we still have some measure of this diversity, are there ways that we can channel the insights of these languages into our conversations about science, language, cognition, etc.? I mean, are there practical things that can be done?
Right. As to the first question, I think everything that can be done is being done, but we need much more of it. We need more linguists, we need more people trained, we need more community activists, more revitalization programs, more funding for those programs, and greater awareness. And I've tried in my work to simply raise awareness that this is a crisis and that we have already have the tools in place to deal with it, but we need to ramp up all of our efforts across the board. And many communities are already engaged in efforts, but they're having trouble finding support for a language revitalization program.
Yeah, is this a job mainly for the academy or for foundations?
Well, it's a classic example where collaboration is needed. Nothing gets done without the indigenous communities themselves deciding to do it. They are the arbiters, the gatekeepers. They decide whether to allow researchers to come in. And then once they do allow researchers in, those researchers need to be supported by the academy, by funding organizations, private foundations. And if the community sets up an immersion kindergarten or a language revitalization program, that also needs to be supported by foundations or granting agencies. So we really need a very broad-based collaborative approach to preserving our common linguistic diversity and heritage.
Yeah, interesting. And then within the academy, is there also then a need for collaboration so that mathematicians, psychologists, people who study language, scientists, have some kind of cognizance of what value there is in these knowledge systems and languages so that we aren't just always knowing what we already know?
Right. I think all branches of science could profit from a better appreciation of indigenous knowledge. And the speakers of the languages themselves are, of course, the conduit to that knowledge. Professional linguists can also serve as a kind of conduit. And I would love to see greater collaborations. There are many times when I'll be working in a community and an elder will want to talk to me, for example, about plants.
Yeah.
And that's the moment when I wish I had a trained botanist at my side who would be coming from a totally different perspective but could really appreciate and systematize the knowledge that these elders do have about plants in a way that I'm not trained to do.
Yeah.
So I would love to see a much broader collaboration and interest across the board, across all the disciplines, in what we can learn from the world's undocumented and endangered languages. So I've co-founded a nonprofit organization. It's called the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages.
Mm-hmm.
And you can visit us on the web at www.livingtongues.org. And on our website, you'll find information about our current projects. We have language documentation and revitalization projects at many sites around the globe, including Native North America. And you'll also find links to many other similar organizations and efforts.
So this is something that anyone can then contribute to.
Yes, Living Tongues Institute is, of course, a nonprofit, and so we rely on private donors and corporate and foundation for much of our work. And we really feel a sense of urgency that this is crucial work that needs to be done within the next 10 years.
Yeah, that's great. So I want to thank you, David, for appearing on our show today. It was absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, Thomas. I was very happy to talk to you and your listeners about it. And
yeah.
I look forward to a great surge of interest in the topic.
Okay, great. Yeah, me too. So we've been talking with K. David Harrison, professor of linguistics at Swarthmore College, about his book, When Languages Die, The Extinction of the World's Languages and the Erosion of Human Knowledge, published by Oxford University Press. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. We're going to fill out the hour today on the Library Cafe with a series of short recordings from the 1995 Folkways CD entitled Tuva, Among the Spirits, Sound, Music, and Nature in Saka and Tuva, in honor of today's guest. The recordings are described as a sonic journey to the steppes of southern Siberia, the wellspring of Tuvan and Sakan music, where the spiritual power of nature is manifested through its sounds and where master musicians imitate and interact with the natural acoustic environment. We'll start with a recording of the sounds of birds, stream water, and imitations of a distant owl. This is followed by the sounds of a Tuvan wild horse roundup. Then we'll hear an example of Tuvan throat singing called cave spirits, actually recorded within a cave. And finally, we'll hear a whistling piece called Sonic Landscape.
Those were selections from the Folkways CD Tuva, Among the Spirits, Sound, Music, and Nature in Saka and Tuva, in honor of today's guest, K. David Harrison. David talked with us today about his work with the Tuva and his book, When Languages Die, The Extinction of the World's Languages and the Erosion of Human Knowledge. Tune in next week when we'll be talking with David Weinberger about his book, Everything is Miscellaneous, about the Internet and the Organization of Everything. If you tuned in late, you can access a podcast of today's interview and previous interviews, as well as a listing of future interviews at our website at library-cafe.org. You've been listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. I'm Thomas Hill.
What if you didn't care about being on the fast track? What if you decided to help someone else get ahead? Peace Corps, life is calling. How far will you go? To find out more, call 800-424-8580 or visit peacecorps.gov.